everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2025, and this is episode 461, which is a conversation about the book Lower Than the Angels, A History of Sex and Christianity by Dermot McCullough. Today's guest is Anne Kennedy. She has an MDiv and is the author of Nailed It, 365 Readings for Angry or Worn Out People. Anne blogs about current events and theological trends on her Substack, Demotivations with Anne. Anne has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal in her Theological Trends column. Her review of this book is called Historian Dermot McCullough's Lens on Sex and Marriage, and you can read it for free on our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Anne, it's good to have you on again.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, as I noted in my intro, Anne has written an in-depth review about a new book that is by Professor Dermot McCullough, and it's called Lower Than the Angels, A History of Sex and Christianity, which is a very ambitious topic to tackle. So who is Dermot McCullough, and why did he write this book? What is his central thesis?
Yes, Professor McCullough. I feel like it's weird to call him by his first name because he's written so much, and I think he's so well known. He was a professor of history at Oxford, and he's retired now. And he's written many very important books that a lot of people in my world have read. In the Anglican world, he's known for his biography of Thomas Cranmer as being one of the best historians on his life. He wrote something called Christianity, the First 3,000 Years, which did very well, was a New York Times bestseller. He's written about the Reformation and church history, and he's just a well-known scholar. Very easy to read, which I think is helpful. His prose is very accessible, but dense, full of facts. And he's also a deacon in the Church of England. So he's a churchgoer, and he has obviously a lot of affection for the church. But this, yeah, as you said, it's a very ambitious look at sex and Christianity.
So what is the central thesis of this book?
Right. Well, I should also say, I forgot to say just before, that he is himself, I don't know what he would call himself, but he is a same-sex attracted person. He's not a heterosexual person. I say he has a very long note about homosexuality and whether or not to use that term or not, but I think that his sexual inclinations definitely drove him to write this book. And as I said in my piece, he obviously has a deep affection for Christianity. It preoccupies him. He knows an enormous amount about the church through history. And yet he is not happy with the idea that the church, the scriptures speak about sexuality in one particular way, namely that they say that sexual activity should only be between a man and a woman in marriage. His task in this book is to dismantle that idea and say that, in fact, the scriptures don't say that clearly, or if they do, they're not authoritative on that matter, and that church history is kind of all over the place, and that it was actually a good thing in the 20th century when many Christians began to say that marriage should not be the only place where sexual activity takes place, but that all the different kinds of sexual tendencies and ideas and feelings and beliefs that people have and behaviors, maybe some of them are bad, but overall, the church is way too narrow, and we should rethink the idea of marriage and sexuality that we've had, because it hasn't always been one thing. That's the sort of quickest way to say what he says in 500 pages.
So as you were saying that he's written a lot about Christianity, but Dr. McCullough is a historian, not a theologian. So I'd like to ask you a little bit about his views toward the Bible. What does he think of scripture, and how does he specifically interact with certain passages like Mary and Jesus, of course, and also the Apostle Paul, for example, in the book of Romans?
Like almost everything that he discusses, he knows an enormous amount about the Bible. His writing about it is very fluid, but he does not believe that most of it is true. Certainly, he doesn't think that a lot of things in the Old Testament, for example, are historically verifiable. And he thinks a lot of the Old Testament was sort of put together in the Second Temple period. And so when it speaks very forthrightly about matters of sexuality, it's something that the people who came to live in the land of Israel sort of gradually developed ideas about God and sexuality that they enshrined in writings that became their scriptures. And Jesus he's not like the people who are, there's some scholars now, I don't know if they would really be counted as scholars, who are trying to say that Jesus didn't even exist at all. But most scholars absolutely would say that Jesus existed as a figure in history. He would agree with that. But he's very cagey on the question of Jesus's divine. He said he would agree that Jesus believed himself to be divine, but whether or not he was, he kind of evades that question. He doesn't believe, say, in the Immaculate Conception, that Jesus was conceived without the aid of a man by God. He speculates that maybe Mary was raped or the victim of sexual violence, and that Jesus became a very important figure, a kind of a revolutionary. And so then he tries to parse out through the Bible section of the book what Jesus might have really said and what he was attributed to have said later, which is a fool's errand. I think a lot of people have tried to do that, and there's no end point, because you can always go on and say that, you know, Jesus did, well, he wouldn't have said that, and he wouldn't have said that, and, you know, it goes on and on. So he tries to parse through. He's that sort of deconstructed way of approaching the scripture, where if you dig around, you might be able to find out what was really said or what really existed. And then a lot of things were added in, and we don't need to think about the things that were added in later. They aren't authoritative in any way. And so Mary probably didn't sing the Magnificat, for example. Somebody wrote that and put it in her mouth. And so he constructs a view of Jesus along those lines, and Mary. And then when he gets to St. Paul, which is a real stickler, because Paul writes so clearly about sexuality and marriage. Of course, Jesus speaks very clearly about it too, but Paul, you know, presses the point home, as it were. Paul is somebody who he believed was adding to what Jesus said or interpreting him. And so his prohibitions against homosexuality are really maybe evidence of himself creating distance between himself and Jesus, that he's just trying to, there's Paul and then there's Jesus. And again, Dr. McCullough would say that we know that some of the letters attributed to Paul were in fact not by Paul, only some of them were. And so the ones that came later, like the pastoral epistles, we don't really need to worry about. They're not that important.
So this is a book about history. It's in the title, A History of Sex and Christianity. How does McCullough structure his discussion of what church history actually is? How does he look at church history?
Well, so I appreciated the sort of flow of the book. He kind of gets into a rhythm where he's moving back and forth across the Christian world. So he deals with the Bible early on, and then he said he has ancient Greek and Jewish history, he deals with Paul, and then he moves into sort of the church history era, you know, post New Testament period. And he deals with marriage in lots of different contexts, with the East, the West, with monasticism, with the rise of the sort of, well, the great many fights about whether or not priests could be married, whether sex was even a good thing inside of marriage. He talks about, you know, very famously Augustinian theology, and he kind of plods through the centuries from the New Testament all the way until the 20th century. And, you know, I am by no means a scholar or an expert on history, but I've read, you know, a good amount, like many others. And I found that his details, his, you know, data, as it were, it was very on point for what I have read in other of other Christian historians. So I don't think he is in any way, you know, messing with the facts of history, but he is shaping it in a way that will allow him eventually to say that it's a good thing that many churches became affirming of the LGBTQ acronym. So he's definitely shaping the narrative and the story to get to that conclusion from the outset. But along the way, he's got a lot of fascinating detail about what people thought about marriage and sex through the centuries, and monasticism and holiness. And there's a lot of, you know, interesting things that people thought in the past and things that they did. So it's a really substantive read. And I would say his approach to history, I mean, he obviously knows an enormous amount and has affection for the past, and that comes through. But he abhors and is angry about the doctors of the church who wrote against homosexuality or who were against divorce and who wrote, you know, movingly about it. He definitely is angry that that comes through as you read, kind of his tone more than anything, when he's articulating or laying out the arguments that so many had in the church through time.
Did you know that the Christian Research Journal has not one, but two audio podcasts? The other podcast that was started last year is called Christian Research Journal Reads, and it brings you audio versions of our articles. This podcast is talking with the authors of the articles about their articles, and the other one is the article itself in audio form. So if you would like to keep up with the articles we're discussing and actually listen to them, because maybe it's easier for you to do that on your commute or while you work out or do some household chores, then please do add the Christian Research Journal Reads podcast to your subscription feed for podcasts. And we're available wherever you do get your podcasts. So thank you for listening, for sharing, for liking, for telling a friend about these two podcasts. And we are grateful for that. And now back to my conversation with Anne Kennedy about the book Lower Than the Angels. A moment ago, you were talking about how McCullough structures church history in the book. And so how does he frame the question of sexuality in Christian history?
That's a huge question. And it's hard to sort of put a finger on it, because there's so many facts. There's so much content in this book that is so fascinating. And it's almost, it feels at times as you're reading, like there's a fog of history. Like, he would really like there to be room for lots of different kinds of sexual practice in church history. But I found that as I was reading, that's actually not the case. There's a pretty narrow amount of sexual activity that Christians thought was viable through history. And so he, through his prose, tries really hard to create a lot of space. But because there's so much that we know, there's so much writing, there's so much that we know about how what people thought and how they lived, because of interesting record keeping and sermons and, you know, monastic the whole monastic period. There's lots and lots to dig into. He would like there to be space, and there just isn't. That's the sort of great irony of the book. I think where he really gets confused, and this again is sort of an impression that I came away with as I just went chapter by chapter, that, and I feel like he's a very clever person, so I'm not sure that this would be something he would do accidentally, but he takes the behaviors and things that people did and tries to use it as the basis, perhaps, of prescription rather than as a description of what happened through history. So, you know, nobody would suggest that Christians behaved themselves perfectly through time. And he has lots of evidence of people behaving badly. And there's this horrible picture he has in the book of a monk who really thought that to show how chaste he was, he would castrate himself so that he could sleep with nuns and, you know, there wouldn't be any problems. Things like that. People did strange and terrible things through history. But by raising all of these examples of behaviors, that things that people did, the implication is that, okay, well, we're doing all these things now and it's no big deal, as if the existence of teaching or the scriptures as an authoritative source to guide Christian life wasn't a thing. I found that to be a little bit perplexing and fascinating that he would take that route rather than admitting, well, Christians believe in the scriptures and they have through the centuries. And the big argument is how to live in light of what we read in the Bible. And we know about holiness from the scriptures, but we're going to just leave that behind and go do something else. He really wants there to be room inside of the Christian world for deviant sexuality. And the only way to do that is to mistake prescription and description.
You noted at the beginning of the podcast that McCullough has publicly stated that he is a gay man. So what does he believe about marriage?
Well, he certainly believes that marriage exists. It's a word that we can all understand. We can talk about marriage. And it's how people enter into it and what it means when they're inside, that's, he would say, very much up for debate. So, you know, through the centuries, the very interesting sections of the book are when did the sort of marriage ceremony that we are familiar with become the habit of people or an assumed idea? It took a long time through history for a priest, for example, to be involved in marriage. It might be just that a man and a woman would, you know, move in together at some point, and it was assumed that that was a marriage. Different parts of, you know, the Christian world through time. And in the Old Testament, the New Testament, you know, you wouldn't put on a big white dress and go to church and take vows and then have a big reception. At the time of Jesus, a wedding would take a week or longer, and you know, there were no vows taken, for example. You wouldn't necessarily go and stand in front of a rabbi, but there were lots of different kinds of ceremonies that occurred. So it's true that the way that people get married today isn't necessarily the norm through Christian history. But he doesn't really weigh in on, you know, what he thinks it ought to be. I think it's more that he would like marriage not to be the settled and sure thing of a man and one man and one woman married together, and that be the only place for sexual activity. He acknowledges that that's true inadvertently, but he would definitely like, I think, that not to be the case. So the whole book, he's talking about marriage mostly, and he's trying to stretch the category. And yet it's so interesting how it really is through time, a man and a woman the question is, when the man or the woman dies, can they get remarried? Can a priest marry? Can you ever get divorced? Can you ever get remarried after divorce? That's really the question of marriage. And marriage does not ever include other kinds of people until the 20th century. And he doesn't come right out and say it, but I mean, essentially that's what his data shows. So I'm not really sure what he believes about marriage. He doesn't really come out and say it. And he's such a good historian that, you know, he's great at what he does. It's a very moving tale, but tragically it doesn't end up, I think, where he would like it to. So he doesn't, I didn't find any place where he just came out and said, well, this is what I believe about marriage. He does really think it should be very inclusive and open-ended, and probably also not the only location for sexual activity, even between people of the same sex. But it's a kind of a fog or a miasma of data from the past.
How do McCullough's perspectives on sexuality within the Protestant tradition compare to his views, for example, about the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox traditions?
Yes, he really gets into the split between the East and the West, and how, you know, the two different views of marriage eventually in the West, it came to be that the clergy just could not marry. And although many of them did, which proved to be a big problem as time went on, that was the habit of the West, mostly, he would say, because of St. Augustine. Whereas the East had a little bit of a, you know, it wasn't quite so straightforward. And there were a lot of differing practices and ideas. So there was, for a long time, the idea that, you know, whether or not married people should really have sexual relations with each other, or as a sign of their commitment and holiness to God, that they might get married, but then not, but then remain chaste and not engage in sexual activity. He does kind of lay all that out. It's a very long, slow tale. And it leads to him in the end, I think, sort of favoring Eastern ideas about spirituality and probably sex as well. By the end, by the time he gets to the 20th century and to Humanae Vitae in the Catholic Church, he's scorching. He really is shocked and saddened by the turn that the Catholic Church took to think about the body in the way that they eventually did. He thought it was several steps backward. And whereas I don't think he would say that the church in the East had the same kind of problems from his view. And it's such a volume, a body of work on the two. And there's so many details between the East and the West. And there were so many differing ideas. It wasn't just, you know, one theologian writing for the entire church on either side, that it's hard to nail down a specific view of sexuality and marriage from the East versus the West. But he really does not appreciate what happened to the Catholic Church, as he would call it. They were on a path towards maybe greater equality, and the rejection of contraception and abortion in the Catholic Church disturbed him enormously, and what that portended for faithful people. In this way, he does very much sound kind of like a Protestant, somebody who believes that you should be able to choose what you do and that you follow the Bible, but there might not be authoritative tradition or, you know, a papal decree that could change the way you were supposed to live your life. That seems very shocking to him when he gets there.
So what does McCullough think about women? Are there any particular modern beliefs or biases that he imposes onto historical narratives?
Yeah, this was another case where it was fascinating to me, his approach to women, because he takes it as read that the best thing for women is sort of modern day feminism. So obviously, it's better for women to have free access to contraception and easy divorce. And it begins early in the book where he just sort of discounts an enormous amount of scripture as being misogynist or not good for women because it didn't feature their voices enough. And obviously he says, you know, for example, the Song of Deborah or the Song of Hannah or the accounts of women in the Bible, that those were all given to us sort of filtered through a patriarchal male gaze. And so women were put upon in the past and they were on a sort of upward trajectory towards greater freedom and liberty. But in many churches, that was constantly thwarted because of, you know, misogyny probably. And I find that extremely specious. For those kinds of people who go at the Bible from the get-go saying that it doesn't take women into account and it's not good for women and the prescriptions of scripture for how women should live are obviously not good and they're not from God. I think that's just a very narrow idea that a lot of people just take as read. And so that really affected how I read the rest of history in terms of women, because in every chapter, he always took time to sort of say what he thought would have been happening to women in, you know, whether that period of history was good for women or bad for women, you know, whether they were getting more liberty or less liberty. And I don't think that's a good way to do history. As a woman, I don't appreciate that view of the scriptures. And so it really made me suspicious of how he was viewing history in general. And if you go at the whole past, the centuries between Jesus and now, assuming that it's good for two men to be together or two women, or that adultery shouldn't have any negative consequences and that divorce is basically fine, and contraception is good, then you are, from my perspective, completely missing the point of the exercise. And you're not speaking Christian language. And so your book about Christianity and sex falls very short of the mark of what people at the time would have believed and felt. And certainly from God's perspective, you know, as a Christian, I believe that God was engaged in history and brought the scriptures into being and had guided the church through the ages. And so if you just take him out, then I don't know what your historical work is doing. And it was really the question of women that made me feel uncomfortable with his project and his posture towards the whole thing.
So as he goes throughout church history, you said he increasingly feels very passionate against, I guess, traditional biblical sexuality as is taught in the Bible as he gets closer to the modern time. So if you think about, you know, 2,000 years of church history, historically, have significant numbers of people believed that homosexuality is approved or blessed by God?
No, there aren't a lot of people. There are definitely people who engaged in same-sex activity with each other. There's a lot of sin through church history. There's a lot of monastic situations that were very less than the mark of holiness. And there's the abuse of children and women through history. I mean, the Bible has examples of the abuse of women. It was in our daily office reading today, the Absalom doing in Amnon after the rape of Tamar. So there's a lot of sordid sexual activity in human history. In the ancient Greek and Roman period, there was a culture that men could essentially groom young men or boys as sexual partners, and then they would go on and get married, and that didn't necessarily constitute an identity. It's really interesting that he does not draw the conclusions, but I don't think he wants to, that the scriptures strongly reject that view of the person, of a coercive sort of devouring sexuality. And he seems baffled by Paul's idea that men and women should have equal claim over each other in their marriage and in their sexuality. And He brings it up over and over again, but he's not willing to sort of delve into it and draw the conclusions that one might draw that the church has been working through for 2,000 years. The what Paul says about men and women in marriage and then what Jesus says and pointing back to Genesis is so profound and so great that it has taken a long time to unpack that. He just would love there to be room, but all the bad behavior of Christians down the ages has never tainted or ruined the things that Paul and Jesus said. In fact, they've continually brought Christians back to greater holiness under an understanding of sexuality. So he just doesn't prove his point, but a lot of bad behavior is there in the book. If you would like, anybody would like to read and learn more about how hypocritical Christians have been down the ages.
So a little bit earlier in the podcast, you started talking about his different positions on abortion and, you know, feminism and those kinds of things. What are some of his views toward this 20th century and some of those kind of issues? Contraception, abortion, the ordination of women in the church, and gay marriage in particular, I'm sure is of interest to him in his outspoken identification as a gay man.
Well, he's very much a fan of all those things. Again, his style is a little bit dispassionate, except when he really doesn't like somebody. Like, he really, really didn't like Chrysostom, really didn't like St. Augustine. And then, you know, you come up into the last century and he really didn't like Jerry Falwell. So he doesn't pretend to have no bias. He has a bias and he owns it throughout. And at the beginning of the final chapter about the last century, he says, I was alive for this period, most of it, and I'm going to write from my own perspective. But again, all of the historical data of the last century is there. But he largely thinks it's good. And the problems that existed were largely because of pushback. So it was great, for example, when the Anglican Lambeth Conference in 1930 said that Anglicans could use contraception within a limited scope. He doesn't really talk about the implications of that or the consequences that have unfolded for Christians, Protestants, especially for almost 100 years now. He excoriates the Catholic Church for being against abortion and birth control. And he blames the church hierarchy for the fact that many Catholics just don't follow those prescriptions. So he's on board. He thinks that the Metropolitan Church, I always get the name of it wrong, that started in the 70s was a really good church. And there's no problem for people who are affirming. They should be able to go to church. He gets into the whole Anglican upheaval that I myself lived through. And he's pretty snide about the group that cut away from the Church of England, of which my church is a member. And he doesn't dwell on it too long, but he thinks it's bad. And that if we're not careful and we don't hang on to these values of free sexual activity, easy divorce, contraception, abortion, we really stand to go back into the dark ages and lose something very precious and special.
McCullough writes about something called the new morality. What exactly is the new morality?
Well, so I hadn't heard this term. I felt kind of, you know, badly educated. But I guess in the 1960s, some person came up with this idea that we were on an upward trajectory and it was time for a new morality. So the old morality of only one man and one woman and only men being ordained and gender distinctions in the church and maybe even the workplace and the home, all that it's time to walk away from. And it's time for the upward call towards full egalitarianism and homosexuality being accepted and, you know, women being welcomed into every part of the church as priests and, you know, ordained clerical offices. That's the new morality. And I think it's a little bit funny because it did, I guess this came about in the 60s. So, you know, it made me sort of think it's like maybe boomer morality or Gen Z morality. It's not that new. And it's also so much of what the scriptures reject. And so in that way, it's quite old. You could go back all the way to the garden and find a certain kind of egalitarianism rear its ugly head, where Eve is invited to make herself equal with God and eat of the fruit. So it's quite old, and but Dr. McCullough thinks it's the best thing. And even though for the last 100 years, well, I guess it's not quite 100 years since the 60s, society has been in turmoil, just roiling with chaos and confusion, such that we even have young people who would say they don't know what kind of gender or sex they have, who they're attracted to. We have a huge divorce rate that has been catastrophic for a generation of young people, longer than that now. And we have exceptionally high rate of abortion in the U.S. at least, but in the West in general, that he would think that we're going somewhere good and delightful is kind of amazing to me. And I don't know what I guess I don't think he would see any of that as chaos, but as a person in the church who often deals with people who are coping with the fallout of horribly broken relationships and sexual confusion and divorce and abortion, it's not a new great morality. It's really a just heaping pile of grief and ruin for many people from the last, you know, 70 years of sexual confusion.
Well, we're thankful that you tackled this book because it's almost 700 pages. Is there anyone that should read this book? Are there certain groups that you would recommend that they read this book?
I've been debating this question within myself for a couple of days, actually, probably when I got to the middle. Dr. McCullough is a great writer, and I enjoyed reading this book. It was a fascinating history through the ages of how Christians in particular viewed sex and marriage. And so I think that if you really love history and you are able to parse through and see the enormous errors, the theological errors that he commits and his very bad posture towards the scripture, and the fact that he assumes the conclusion before he begins writing, which are really devastating troubles to find in a book. I would never recommend a book normally that has any of those particular problems to anyone. I guess if you are really curious about the subject and are really grounded and maybe wanted to read it in a group, I think some of the chapters could be really provocative and interesting to think, especially maybe as in an opposite way from what he would probably desire, but to think about how Christians in the past did view sex as we try to recover some of the wreckage, you know, rebuild some of the communities that have been lost because of sexual chaos. It might be interesting to look at his book from that light and look at what customs and ideas and assumptions in the past existed that might be helpful for us now. But as just you by yourself reading it, I don't know. I don't think I would recommend it. Plus, it's really long, and most of us have a hard time reading books that long these days.
Well, thank you for that insightful analysis of his book. And now for just a lighter, fun question. In September, we have all these odds and ends holidays, and one of them is the National Lazy Mom Day. So if you could be a lazy mom for a day, what would you do?
Wow, I think I would catch up on my reading because I have a huge stack of books sitting here that I've let flounder. And I would definitely go read some great novels if I had a whole day to myself.
Well, thanks, Anne, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 461 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Anne Kennedy. She has written a feature article book review for the Christian Research Journal in her Theological Trends column. Her review is called Historian Dermot McCullough's Lens on Sex and Marriage. And you can read it for free without a paywall at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.